Even though it's true that Mahashivratri is one particular day of the year, it's also true that it's a holiday that is omnipresent throughout the final period of Kali Yuga, because Shiva's presence is becoming ever more maha, ever more attunable, ever more accessible, and ever more unavoidable for even those who would like to avoid, for their own negative reasons, divine presence. And as it becomes more powerful, the light will shine internally as well as externally, more magically and brightly, and you will forget the character, and all you will remember is all is Shiva. There's only Shiva. And it's that kind of transformation that is underway at the same moment that we are experiencing an accelerated series of catastrophic events in which indeed everyone is losing everything, and whether in earthquakes or in other kinds of disastrous situations. And that losing everything, once you realize that losing your character is actually gaining God, turns out to be a blessing, not a horror. And it's only when we understand that we are free of fear and desire and any judgment about why this is happening or any confusion, and the wisdom and the power of that Supreme Presence fills you with the realization of the eternal and immortal nature of consciousness, but consciousness free of all that is definable and temporary and in a flux of time, of coming and going, of appearance and disappearance, but instead an eternal presence of light and intelligence that can turn that light into worlds. And worlds are no different than dreams. And dreams are no different than tableaus of display of the divine capacity to bring about the miraculous. And that capacity is omnipresent, doesn't belong to anyone because there isn't anyone. There is only that awareness that is whole and entire and saturates and works through the apparently separate beings. Because there's a background radiation of a vibrational frequency of waves that carry information and that carry the drives, the urgency that once the ego is attuned to it or affected by it, finds itself acting in accord with it and assuming it's its own free will to do so, but it turns out to be the will of this vast intelligence that is organizing and choreographing all of it. And nothing has to do with any individuals because there is no such thing as an individual separate from all of that. And it's this realization then that enables the total dropping away of all the anxieties and concerns and the ego itself, because of its unreal nature that is only a block to the full revelation of all of the implications of that information. And that blocks the awareness of the source of that information. And once you recognize that that source is yourself, then there is liberation. And so because this is Mahashivaratri, I'm going to ask Hanuman to sing a Mahashivaratri song for us that probably in conventional terms should have been sung a few days ago, but we already had so much music that somehow that one dropped out. But there's a song that should be sung because I think it's ever more appropriate to the nature of the transvaluation that is underway, whether we are deliberately attempting to understand reality in a new paradigm or not. There is some change that happens at a very subtle level that saturates our consciousness and suddenly provokes new ideas, new possibilities that could not have emerged before. And there's a freedom of the imagination that is now in attunement with its infinite nature that allows a different way of navigating through this apparent flux of time, but which is actually only the pixels of an eternal presence that are constantly modifying their positions in relation to one another like a kaleidoscope. But the kaleidoscope itself never moves. But there's just this constant turning of possibilities and wonders that are ever new and ever different and ever unique. But always it's the same one vast intelligence simply showing you all of its potentialities. And in the same way, Hanuman is going to show us a new potentiality of music to express the nature of his soul's yearning. Please.
Like all lovers, you and I. chosen devotee, receive your lethal grace. The truth that you and they were never real, all was just a dream.
It caused some symptoms, but that's the price of art.
Price of truth.
Poison is our nectar.
Yeah, the nectar is poison to the ego. I hope that song didn't disturb anyone, but then again, maybe that's what had to happen.
By the way, Hanuman, being the great hero that he is in music, we've decided that the next retreat, I've changed the title. It's now The Heroism of Hanuman. And what's the subtitle that we gave it? Do you remember, Nirgun?
No.
You don't remember it? Okay.
The Heroism of Hanuman.
Uh-huh. Okay, never mind. Doesn't matter. There's a long subtitle. But the reason we're doing that, one reason we're doing it, is that the retreat actually falls on Hanuman Jayanti in India. It's Hanuman's actual birthday. They celebrate every year. I don't know about actual birthday, you know, but it's actually the day they celebrate as his birthday. And it's also in the same period is Ram Navami, which is the birthday of Ram, right? So Ram and Hanuman being both the primary characters of the Ramayana mythological saga, and because that saga summarizes and expresses the essence of the secrets of reality more than any other text, I think, has ever been able to capture. And it could only have been captured in that kind of a pseudo-fictional context in which the characters of each aspect of the archetypes that make up the soul of every being could be expressed in their interactive nature of relationality that then gets expressed in one's life as well as in one's psychological constitution. So it's I think it's an appropriate, let's say, object of study, and I think it will lead us all to get into a very deep level of who we really are, because in a certain way we are playing out the echoes of those original characters in our own lives that are somehow microcosmic replays of the same thematic struggle for freedom, for liberation, for union, and for a return of a world of goodness and a world that is coherent and makes sense and makes the creation again into a clearly divine artifact. So this is, I think, a very magical moment, and it's worth taking advantage of this holiday, because not coincidentally it's occurring around the same time that there are Christian holidays and holidays of other traditions that are congruent with the same thematic. And I think it's worth plunging into the depth of this wisdom that has been presented by the spiritual traditions to be immersed in at this moment in time. And I think when we come out of it, we will find ourselves very much transformed by the event of recognition of who we really are behind the character that we're playing at this moment, that is in itself only a, let's say, a somewhat degraded form of the original presentation of the same play, in which we may have played other roles. In fact, all of the roles of the this performance that has so many permutations and so many implications that it requires an entire cycle of history in order to present itself in its fullness. And now all of that is coming to a climax. So it is, because that climactic moment is so well expressed in the Ramayana, it's a good leaping off point for spiritual liberation. So I've talked enough. Hanuman has sung enough, at least for tonight. So the floor is open if anyone wishes to say anything or about the whatever the topic was I've been talking about, or about the song, or about anything that your soul wishes to throw into the conversation.
Namaste.
Namaste.
And thank you so much for, I think the meditation was exquisite. I don't have another way of describing how it felt. I was, I could say a lot about the meditation in itself, but there was a moment where you described that one is in this unity and is in this unconditional acceptance. And I've had this question for a while now because I want to understand the difference. We've been talking about for many months or maybe years, radical acceptance. And lately, you've been talking more about unconditional acceptance. And although I can't quite see the difference or understand the difference, there's a quality of the vibrational frequency which is different. And I was wondering if you could speak to that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think unconditional is even more radical than radical, right? Mm-hmm. Radical goes to the root, and in a way, it's a way of expressing the ability to now accept what you couldn't accept, let's say, in the past or in some other context that mm-hmm. now you're okay with, and you're not shocked by anything or disturbed or anything else. But the unconditional acceptance is the realization that that has always been the case, and that's the real in itself is a state of total acceptance. There's no resistance. Mm-hmm. There's just a total flow of bliss all the time and all for all eternity. Mm-hmm. And so it's not radical because you haven't gone to a root. You are that, you mm-hmm. know, root, flower, stem, everything is, it's all one though. And because there are no conditions, you have reached a point where you have transcended all the possible shocks or slings and arrows of outrageous fortune or what, however else you might have conceived the need to accept, to be a part of. Mm. But now it's simply what you are.
Thank you. That's very useful. Just one follow-up question is, it seems to me that there's also a reason why you are now using unconditional acceptance as opposed to before. Mm-hmm. So I thought, well, maybe it's part of our training, right? Radical acceptance, even if you don't understand, you accept because it's Shiva's will. But unconditional seems to have this kind of love implicit in it and kind of, well, you said bliss. To me, it was like unconditional. It's Shiva. Yeah. I just accept. It's perfect. It's beautiful. It's the most benevolent. It's the most loving outcome that could happen.
Yes.
And I don't know if that's what...
Yeah, no, that's beautiful. I think you added something very important to the definition.
Okay. And it seems to me that because of the current world situation and even the chaos that is ever accelerating every day, right? There's more and more cuts, and we have to be in this unconditional acceptance. So not only radically accept, but lovingly accept.
Yes, I agree with you. I think the love is a key. And maybe one of the other differences would have been that the radical acceptance is I accept it despite the fact that I don't agree with it or I wish it were different or, you know, something like that. But here there's such a humility and an openness to an infinite intelligence that knows so much more than you do that the idea of judging anything as being a flaw or wrong couldn't even occur.
Yes.
There's just, obviously, God is doing everything and it's all perfect.
Yes. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Namaste, Shunya.
Namaste.
So I have become aware of, a movement, you can say, that is going on, that started a few weeks ago at a Christian college, university in in America, Ashbury, it's called.
Oh, yeah, yeah, I heard you about that. Yes, a revival.
The revival,
yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just very touched when I saw what was going on there, how just spontaneously this revival has started there, and how it has attracted so many people from all over, and how this movement is expanding, it's growing, it's overflowing to other universities and places and cities in all over the world, as I understand it, that people are coming to Christ and to repent and to surrender.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just you know, wondering if this is a way of for God. Is this how He manifests Himself?
Yeah, it's one of many ways, but yes, it is. Sure, I think. Because people do see the helplessness, the corruption, the horror of it, what else can you do ultimately but turn to God? There's no other help on this plane when the government itself is the problem. You can't call the police when they're the ones who are the problem, right? You can't call the government. You can't call anyone, right? So there is a sense when you have reached a point where you've lost trust in everyone and everything, mm-hmm. and all that is, that the only last hope is God, and then you give it all to God, because that's all that remains as the last spark of possible redemption. And so the more people who do turn that to that way of leading life as devotees in a constant pilgrimage of remembrance of God and prayer and of invocation of the presence of God, the more that presence will in fact be palpable to more and more beings. And this is part of the initial stages of what the Christians call the rapture. So it will. And I'm sure the same things are happening among Buddhists, and I know it's happening in India among Hindus, and it's happening, in, I think, in everywhere, because there is no other place to turn. So, yeah, I think it's a very positive and beautiful awakening that is happening. And it's part of the whole panorama of what's happening. It isn't going to stop the earthquakes and the wars and all of that, but it will provide another note of meaningfulness that will, I think, open the hearts of more and more people to the need to end this hell realm, because the last freedom we have is to not give consent for this world to exist, if it's going to exist as an evil world controlled by even aliens or transhumanists or whatever you believe that they are. But as soon as you don't give consent to it anymore and you have turned completely to God, then what you have actually done, because the world is a collective dream field, it doesn't really exist. And you have now asked God to come and redeem the world from this state, that redemption will in fact be the result on a collective level.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the singularity that we always talk about, where God's light just fills, not only fills the world, but washes away the illusion of a world.
Thank you
for bringing that up. I think it's an important event that's going on.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Namaste, Shinya.
Namaste.
Thank you for the meditation. It's very beautiful. I wanted to ask about the relationship between innocence and, not exactly sin, but, and then the return back to innocence. So, in childhood, in early childhood, there was innocence. And then there was indoctrination into wanting that which I didn't want, but then became, that was literally, I was playing a part in a film. I entered an adult world, right, where to be savvy, to be cool, to be meant to want to be sexy and sexual and to transgress. And no, what it meant was to lose one's innocence. Innocence wasn't cool. And so I had to play the role of wanting to be a criminal, let's say, or to transgress the law, right? That's mm-hmm. what was needed from a very, very young age, which created a lot of anxiety and a lot of... And so now, I'm wondering, now that that's been, I don't know, has come up, how does one return to innocence?
Well, there are many levels of innocence, because the innocence of, let's say, the newborn baby is almost like that of the amnesia that we were describing right. in the meditation, right? Right? It's just wonderment. There's no one even who's innocent. It's that innocent, right?
Right.
So there's no ego. And then that evolves into a very naive sense and a gullible sense and a childlike, because one is still a child, but that childlikeness can remain of a kind of living on the surface of what is presented, rather than seeing the transgressors and the evildoers and the ulterior motivations of what's going on, and being free of tainted by it, of being tainted. And then a moment comes where one is indoctrinated or inducted or abused, traumatized, and one loses one's innocence, often in a very drastic way, or one is seduced in a very gradual way. Obviously, in many ways this can happen. And then it's not just a lack of innocence that happens, but a thrill and an enjoyment of the guilt and the sin and the ability to hurt people and to take advantage and to be one up and, right, all of that. That's part of what the psychopathic mentality is about, right? And it's the enjoyment of it that's the problem. And then hopefully one reaches a point where one recognizes the horror of that and you don't want to be that character anymore. And that's why one kills one's ego, is one realizes it has become monstrous, right? It has become so untruthful that it has become incoherent to itself, because it can no longer keep its lies straight, and because you have to have so many different ones, and you have so many different sub-personalities to use in different situations to get your way with different people, etc. And it's such a complex system that the ego has become that it's exhausting. You can't maintain it anymore. And then if there is a true conversion experience where you recognize that your real self is the soul that was not touched by the ego, then you reach, if you kill the ego and realize the soul nature of your consciousness, you reach a different kind of innocence. It's not the same as the child pre-ego, but it's the wisdom of the post-egoic consciousness that understands it isn't going to be taken advantage of by the evil egos out there, no, but can have compassion and understanding and an ability to cope with them, and even to offer healing and offer a path out of their hell realm to those who are interested, but without any need to proselytize or right indoctrinate anyone else into whatever one has learned. And that wisdom then will bring one to an even higher state of God consciousness, which is the ultimate innocence that's transcendent of all worlds. And you realize you were never in the world at all. You weren't that character, either in its innocent or its guilty state. And that freedom of having been tainted and needing purification also is let go as part of the illusion of the matrix that you were never in. And then that you reach the ultimate innocence.
Beautiful.
So I hope that answers the question.
It does.
Thank you for bringing that up. A beautiful question. Natural for a dramatist. Hopefully we will all reach the final act of this play.
Yes.
and reach our ultimate innocence again.
Beautiful. Thank you, Shanya.
Thank you.
Namaste, Shanya.
Namaste.
Thank you. My question relates actually both to Mahalakshmi's and to Nirmala's question. Mm. I've been thinking a lot about the people I follow, the researchers and the truth tellers who have committed so much of their time and their effort and their livelihood to sorting out, attempting to sort out what's going on in the phenomenal world right now, at great cost to their careers and their reputations and their livelihoods and their relationships, actually. Mm-hmm. And my question is whether all that is actually for naught in the biggest scheme of things, mm-hmm. or whether it doesn't reflect love and compassion, you know, sort of the highest levels of love and compassion and devotion among humans. That's what it feels like to mm-hmm. me. So it's a huge act of dedication and devotion, but it's not going to fix things, I don't think, ultimately.
Well, nothing needs to be fixed, you see, but they are playing heroic roles in the mm-hmm. drama. So, yeah, you can't say it's for naught. But at the same time, it's not the highest level of wisdom and understanding, because then they would be aware of God consciousness and all, the perfection and the fact that there really isn't even a world. It is a dream, and they would wake up from it right at that highest level. But as long as you're in the dream, it is, in fact, our duty, our dharma, to play those highest roles of standing up for truth, goodness, purity, love, joy, all of those things, and to not be affected by the intimidation, the fear, the attacks, the slander and libel, all of that, that anyone will face if they speak the truth. Yes. So it's a very important trait of humanity, and without that, we couldn't have sustained our existence even this long. And it's only because the masses have lost that courage that we are in the situation we are in. If millions of doctors and nurses who had been accomplices in this refused to go along with it and said, take my job, I don't care, but I'm not going to start killing people for you, and I'm not going to lie, this could never have happened. So we need more of those truth tellers. And the real problem is there's a shortage of them. But no, I think that they should all those who do that work at whatever level of truth that they have realized, indeed, should be supported and congratulated. But nonetheless, we should also keep rising mm-hmm. to higher levels of it, because as things become more hopeless, they will become despairing and lose that courage if there isn't a higher level of recognition of the perfection of it all.
Thank you. That's very helpful.
Thank you.
So, we recently, I'm not sure kind of how to ask this question, but there has recently a video been passed around about nuclear wars, and And I was wondering, there's a video and it showed about the cloud cover that it won't hit in Costa Rica, but there will still be like coverage over Costa Rica. And how do we prepare? Or what, how do we live in that situation?
Or no, don't worry about it. Shiva will take care of us. He'll blow the winds in other directions. Don't be afraid. All will be well. And we may all be in the singularity before that happens anyway. So be with God and trust and have faith rather than try to get into how do we deal with this and all of that. I don't think that's the appropriate strategy for dealing with the end of the world. What we want is to be so much with God that you won't even notice because there is no world. There's only God. All of this is only God. And when you're in that state of total love and bliss, you won't notice what happens. That should be our focus. Okay?
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Namaste.
Namaste.
Today in class, a question came up about identification, or at least I had the question, and how that mechanism is put together, because we come in as celestial beings and immediately there's identifications made that are going to be with us for how many years or until we process what's actually happening or did happen. Mm-hmm. And I just want, that was, it's like we've identified with identification or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, it's a very good question. You know, whole books have been written about this, and in fact, whole schools of psychoanalysis and psychology. There's a famous work by Hans Eysenck. There's a famous a theory of ethology. There's a famous theory of mimesis to try to describe this. There's Lacan's theory of the mirror stage, you know, which may be the most easy to grasp, that the identification is, first of all, it's at the level of real one, where the baby is identified with the mother, because coming out of the body of the mother, the vibrational frequency is the same, and there's a natural love, at least in most situations, between those beings. So it's not so much as of an identification as a merger, right? I and the mother are one, but not that you think that. Obviously, it's pre-language, but there is that sense. And then at the point of again, what Lacan calls the mirror stage, the mother actually literally will hold the child up in her arms before a mirror and say, "That's you." And the child at that point, if it has a little bit of language already, will look at that image and say, "Ah, that's me." And then there will be an immediate identification with that image, and that will become a self-image, along with all of the feelings that the mother has about the child that she is looking at. And so it could be an image, oh, look, what a loving little boy or girl, right? Or what a brat or whatever, depending on the context and the feeling state of that relationship. But that will create the initial imaginary level of identification. And then there will be, at another time, a symbolic identification in which not only are you aware of your name and your family and your role in society and the religion that you're indoctrinated into and all of that, but that a certain ego ideal will be given to you, which will be a sense of this is what you should do in life, you know. And then suddenly, you know, you're 6 years old, but you're already a lawyer or a doctor or, you know, whatever, because mommy and daddy have said that's what you're going to do, right? So the ego ideal, when that's installed, then that creates a whole cascade of drives that are in accord with that ultimate goal that will cause the social and the intellectual development to go in a certain way and not to go in other ways, right? Because if you're supposed to be an accountant, then you're not going to be encouraged to study art and drama and right things like that. Or it could be the reverse. And also you will have a certain role in the family system. You'll either be the golden child or you'll be the black sheep or the scapegoat, right? Or you'll be the forgotten middle child, or you'll be one of those different roles that are assigned. And then those will be also parts of your identity that will be reflected in all your future relationships. So there are different levels and stages in which the identification is packed into you. And then when you're in school and you're socializing with others and finding your place in the pack and the pecking order and who gets picked first or last for the baseball team or whatever, then that will add another layer to it. But all of these different layers will eventually lead to whatever is the final adult egoic identification that will be based on the mimesis or the imitation of those who were most popular and most successful in your circle. You'll try to imitate them to get approval and to be like them and to not imitate the ones who are the losers and the unpopular, unless you have been put in that category or your place in the family system was the oppositional one who always says no and I don't want to do it and I don't want that ice cream and all that. So your role may determine how that identification has to play out in order to sustain itself. But eventually it becomes a set of algorithms that move robotically and you don't even control it anymore. It just happens, reflex reactions to events, and you're not even there anymore. The identification takes over from your real identity.
Okay. I
hope that's useful.
A lot of information there.
Yeah. Well, you asked for it. So.
No. Yes, I did. that impulse of the identification making that happens, you know, early birth and on through. There's the idea that is it like a sponge? The need for an identification that happens that quickly?
Yeah, there is a need because the child is helpless. And if it's abandoned, it will die, right? Mm-hmm. So abandonment is a terror that's almost inherent. And therefore, not to be abandoned, I need to be loved. And to be loved, I need to be approved of, mm-hmm. right? So yes. I'm going to do whatever I know will get the approval and attention of mommy and daddy, and right? So then if they don't want you to grow up and they want you to stay at home, then that's what you're going to do. And if they want you to become the doctor who, you know, makes millions, that's what you're going to do. So whatever is your role in the system, then because you need approval and validation from the other, that will then extend to your PhD thesis and, you know, everything else in life. And you will always be constantly looking for that approval and those pats on the back to make you feel okay.
Did me good. Thank you.
Thank you. But that's all at the ego level. If you can reach the soul level and negate the ego, that's when you have freedom again to decide who am I in a completely different context. That's infinite. That's not based on I am this, you know, body that was born to these other two bodies that conceived me, and I have to be loyal to that tradition that they represent, etc. But you are now in a context where God is father and mother, and you are free to explore the infinite reaches of your consciousness.
You.
Okay. All right.
Thank you. Okay, I've got a couple of questions.
Uh-oh.
Well, I think they're follow-ups from the questions that have already been asked. So going on to that, validation and need to be thought of as good I think. So you're not abandoned, right? Mm-hmm. I was thinking about... I remember that you once defined the unconscious, or the reason that we create an unconscious is to be able to lie with a straight face. Yeah. And I was just like thinking about this whole thing of needing to be good and mm-hmm. having to conceal your ulterior motives and all of these sorts of things. And mm-hmm. you're really playing with, you know, a hand or both hands tied behind your back.
Yeah, but you tie them yourself in order to have another hand that's free. You see, that's the thing. It's a pseudo tie because you repress certain information, like I actually hate my mother because I need to act like I love my mother, right? And I can't know that I actually hate her or I'm angry at her. I want to kill her because she didn't let me go to, you know, the party with whatever, you know. So the child's attitude has to do that in order to be able to hold on to its sense of security. It would be too massively anxious if it knew that it was lying because it assumes the other knows what you're actually thinking. It takes a long time before the child realizes, oh, they don't know what I'm thinking, you know? Then you really start to lie and get out of control. So I hope that answers that.
Well, how to get out of it, I think is what I was leading to.
Oh, well, how you get out of it is you realize you're only really fooling yourself. And because this is all a dream, you're creating karmic backlashes and needs to let go of all of these levels of falseness and of compensatory, let's say, narcissistic greatness when you feel like you're worthless because your parents didn't give you the unconditional love you demanded from them, and you're disappointed, and you're in a state of feeling like you've been cheated by reality, you know, and by so many other people are getting so much more than I'm getting, and why is that? And right, all of those feelings create a kind of a self-hatred and a negative attitude about oneself, and a narcissistic compensation of greatness and megalomania to try to avoid that negative feeling that then creates more problems and more backlash and more inability to relate to the other. And so eventually you realize you have created a system of relationality that doesn't work. It's a block to any kind of honest intimacy. And when you reach a point in life, usually after puberty, where you need to be able to establish a relationship, you've got to be able to speak truthfully from your heart, even though you may have never done that, you know, or not since you were a baby. And so if you're going to do that, then you have to clear away the sludge of denial and self-hatred in order to be able to attune to someone else's, you know, issues and levels, and not have a reflex angry response to someone who doesn't give you the pat on the back that you want, so that you don't destroy the relationship, but that you can actually continue to grow and reach levels of rapport or semi-rapport, at least that enable a stable kind of social system of friendships and other kinds of relationships to be able to flower without constantly feeling so totally lonely that abandonment anxiety doesn't take over your life. If it does, then you start needing opioids and, you know, fentanyl and all of these things. People are, and suicides happen, right? Because that is the fate of the ego, because it won't get what it wants. So the need to establish that, to adapt to a social role that will be acceptable, will cause you to have to reconfigure the ego.
And I think it ties into the innocence question, because there's at that first level in which one's playing with, you know, mm-hmm. lying with a straight face or mm-hmm. playing with an arm tied behind one's back, there's not a capacity to have access to all of one's powers and mind. And sure. one wants to reach a stage in which one can tolerate all of that and then begin to figure things out. And I wonder if, because an idea that came to mind when you were speaking was that there has to be like a shift of love for even for growth
that can motivate. There should be. There doesn't have to be. And I think these days that very rarely happens. It requires a social system that offers a rite of passage into a level of being that was not determined by the family system and by the tribal order. And that's why there were vision quests and all of that, and why there were certain people in a society who would hold the position of a shaman or some other magical kind of consciousness that wasn't part of the system, that someone could then use and learn from to be able to put the ego to death, basically, and that whole identity structure, and then discover who you are from your own infinite potentiality again. But that idea doesn't even occur to most people who today, because they don't go through a rite of passage, they never become psychological adults. And they remain in the puer eternus, as Jung called it, right? And so most people are in that puerile condition in which that idea of letting go of the child ego, the larval state of identity, to become a butterfly doesn't even occur to them. And that transformation never happens. And most people never find a guide or the kind of help needed to accomplish it.
Okay, last question. In regards to Carl's question, I don't know if identity is the right word for it, but I'm curious about this, how this functions through time, because I know you've said before that in previous yugas, I'm wanting to use the word identification, but let's say consciousness is operating from the level of spirit, and there may be still appearances of bodies or whatever, even if of light, and then later of soul. One is operating from soul rather than ego. Is there identification with those things, or how does that work?
Well, I think if you go back to Sat Yuga, right, which is that original golden age of the world, everyone was identified with this absolute universal consciousness. So there's a oneness. But that oneness is now manifesting as many, but the consciousness is recognizing that everyone is a manifestation of the self. And so there's no competition or envy or desire or fear or any of that. There's just a perfect natural choreography of relationality where no one gets in anyone else's way, and it's just a natural thing. It's like if you ever see swarms of gnats out there, they usually don't run into each other, right? They're doing this incredibly complex dance, but it's somehow spontaneously choreographed so that it all works and nobody falls down having crashed, you know, as they do with F-35s and things like that. So, you know, they're much more intelligent because they're attuned. They don't have egos getting in the way. So in the golden age, there's no ego and not even a soul level. It's just pure unified spirit. And then in the silver age, that's lost in their soul. And then in the Dwapar Yuga, the copper age, it's sattvic ego and some soul left. And then Kali Yuga's ego with a few, you know, sages salted in, but less and less as you go beyond what they call the axial age, you know, the classical period where You had Socrates and Buddha and Lao Tzu and all of those people. And then suddenly, you know, now we're just following in the traditions that they started, but very little new inspiration comes. And so we're now in a desert where everyone's in their rigid little ego. And that's why it has to end. We have to break out of that. Okay?
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. We're all out of time officially, but if you have a burning question, go ahead, please. Yeah.
I really appreciate the teachings that we've been having during this course. It's just given me a wider template and the to follow in doing everything in life.
Wonderful.
But one of the things that I want to pay more attention to or be with is meditation. Because I'm almost finding like it's, at first it was really easier for me, and now it feels like I'm, like all this, I don't know, is coming in. And it's,
what is that? Give me a little more description than that. No.
Well, in the past I've had sort of, okay, so the question is about, I've had simple ways of going from my heart to my mind. Mm-hmm. Greg Braden teaches his heart math, stuff based mm-hmm. on heart math. And so I would go with gratitude to my heart and go up to my mind. And then what I understand is you create gamma rays, which are the higher rays of meditation in the mind that goes from the back part of the mind to the front part. And that being in that place, I would just allow the light to happen and bring the light down from the, I used to call it the inconscience. Mm-hmm. And bring that light down and be in my body with it mm-hmm. and just allow that to expand me and then to go into the stillness. Mm-hmm. And since I've been here, I think I'm striving more to be, like what came to me last night is I have this sign on my fridge that's been there forever, be still and know that I am God. Mm-hmm. But I've always taken it as God being out there. Mm-hmm. And last night it hit me. That I am, it's telling me to be I am God. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's what...
Yeah, but the I am is not the bodily I, you see. It's the right. I that is expanded into what you just described in that previous meditation. Although whether you need to conceptualize gamma rays or any of that, I don't know, that I don't think that's necessary. But that entirety of infinite consciousness is I, right? Not a bodily being who needs to go through any process in order to get there, because there is the I. And so mm-hmm. it's automatic. So you don't even need to meditate. And there is no one to meditate, because the character is the illusion that you're dropping. So drop it once and for all, and there's no one left to need to do anything.
Okay.
You're free. That was easy. Namaste.
Thank you.
Okay, I hope everyone's problems are that easy to solve and that all are abiding in bliss in your natural state. And I hope that this gathering was useful to you. And we'll be gathering again on Tuesday evening, because we're going to be having a Rose Day celebration. And I think that will be enjoyable for everyone. And more music and poetry and... maybe even some wisdom, but I think, you know, we basically go from one party to another one here. So the end of the world doesn't seem so bad, you know. This is the kind of revival I like anyway, but, you know, it's take as much of a dose of it as you want. But realize you're already free. You're already in bliss. The ego is a delusion. Let it drop away and keep the mind... not congested with thoughts, but just open to your own infinite beauty, and all will be well. So thank you all. Thank you, Hanuman, especially for that lovely rendition of the song, and thank you all for all the bright, joyous light that you contribute to our energy fields. Namaste. Namaste.